Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin on the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's most experienced active investment managers. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Capital Client Group, Inc.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Future-proof extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, when we think of the path of human history, we tend to build our narratives around the movement of great armies or technology. But intrinsic to any event in our history is the reality that all of the actors are human and that individually we are beholden to our biology. And so often it is our susceptibility to things like bias or disease or even something like milk that could be the root cause of geopolitical change. But Professor Lewis Dartnell is an astrobiology research scientist at the University of Westminster, and he's the author of Being Human, How Our Biology Shaped World History. He joins me now. Welcome back to the program. Good to have you, Lewis. Tell me a little bit about this book, because it does seem to be a different from the previous stuff we've spoken to you about, which is, you know, astrobiology.
Yeah, so we've talked about astrobiology in the past, and I have written a book on astrobiology called Life in the Universe. But my two most recent books have been The Knowledge, which is all about how you could rebuild the world from scratch after some kind of apocalypse. It, you know, takes as its fun conceit at the beginning, there's been some global catastrophe, and you're trying to recover and rebuild and reboot civilization as quickly as possible. So at the end of the day, it's not about the end of the world. It's about how our world works behind the scenes and all the things we just take for granted in our modern lives. So it's about the history of science and technology. And my previous book, Origins, is all about how features of the planet that we live on, features of the Earth, how they've had a huge guiding influence from thousands of years of human history. So things like plate tectonics or atmospheric circulation, or where different metals and resources can be found. And so what I've done with this new book, with Being Human, How Our Biology Has Shaped World History, is kind of kept that same grand perspective that I enjoyed writing about for The Knowledge and Origins, and now turned it inwards. I've held up a mirror to us as a species and looked at how different features of our humanness, the things which are intrinsic to us as an animal, have been really important through history. So that's aspects of our genetics and DNA and mutations, or our psychology and cognitive biases, or our anatomy and how our bodies are built.
Well, let's talk about that then. Let's start off with our anatomy. What about human anatomy has had an enormous impact on our existence?
So one of the examples I talk about right in the beginning of the book, right in the introduction, is there's something very interesting about most human languages, and there are thousands and thousands of different tongues and different cultures and societies around the world. But one of the most common phonemes, one of the most common sounds in all human languages is m, you know, where you sort of bring your lips together and do a sort of sound. And this is very, very closely related to the lip smack behavior of chimpanzees. And so there seems to be a direct link between what our bodies find easiest to do when it comes to forming different shapes with our mouths, create different sounds, which we then string together in this incredibly complex string of sounds, which is human language. The most common of those sounds has got a direct link, as far as we can tell, back to chimpanzees and the very beginnings of language and communication in the first place. And for me, that struck me as one of these, like, you know, smack you in the face, surprising, astonishing facts about something we just take for granted, but how it has got really deep roots in who we are and where we came from as we were evolving.
And this this ability to make these sound that you're saying that has had an enormous effect on our evolution or our progression as a species?
Well, in a sense, that particular example is so fundamental, you can't really imagine human history without it. You can't imagine human history without language and the ability for us to communicate with each other and share ideas and information and knowledge and plans, and therefore cooperate in huge populations of people, which is effectively what civilization is. But for the rest of the book, I look at things where, you know, there is a particular aspect of our human bodies or our human existence and what the effects those have had through history.
Yeah, one of the things which I hadn't really considered, we've talked around this subject a good few times in the program, but monogamy versus polygamy, our tendency towards monogamy in society versus our natural inclination towards polygamy. You kind of go into this in the book. What's your take on it?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. In the Western industrialized world today, monogamy is by far the most common sort of mating system, if you see what I mean. It's where one woman and one man have sex or in a marriage together to create children. But when you do a sort of when you do a deep time survey of many, many different human cultures and societies, including lots of hunter-gatherer societies, polygyny ends up being very, very common, if not even more common than monogamy in societies where one man takes several wives. Hmm. And when you look at the historical consequences of that, the example I pull out in Being Human is Henry VIII was in a monogamous society. It was the cultural norm, and indeed it was the religious expectation as well, to have married to one woman at a time. And when you're the king and you've got this enormous weight of responsibility to have a child as an heir, to carry on your dynasty, to succeed to you in the throne, and ideally a male heir, a son, there's this huge pressure for that simplest and most fundamental of human functions, which is to just have children, to just reproduce. And Henry VIII's response to this was to effectively divorce or kill one wife after another until he tried to get that security of an heir and a spare. Whereas his contemporary, Suleiman Magnificent, who was the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, was within a polygynous culture. He was under no threat whatsoever that he wasn't able to produce a number of princes to help continue that dynasty. So that fundamental aspect of human life, of reproduction, and the different ways you can go about having children, and how different societies through history have taken different trajectories, different aspects of that, and then what the historical consequences of that have been.
Yeah, how we create offspring features a couple of times in the book. You talk about the Habsburgs and inbreeding and how inbreeding has shaped political history.
Yeah, so one of the fundamental aspects of humanity is that we are a very intelligent species. We have big brains and we're bipedal. We walk around on 2 feet. But those two things, those two evolutionary adaptations are at loggerheads with each other, but they're in direct conflict. Because when you are being born and brought into the world, your skull with its big brain has to pass through the birth canal, has to pass through a hole in your mother's pelvis, which is being kept small by the evolutionary pressures for having to walk upright. And the solution to that problem that evolution hit upon in our own lineage was to give birth to very vulnerable children and then have several years of development outside the womb as the great brain can grow a bit bigger, but you're entirely dependent on your mother and then also your father. So having biparental investment, having two parents raising your child, is actually very, very rare in the animal kingdom. And out of that came the human notion, the human emotion of romantic love. There has to be a deep bond between mother and father, so they stick together as a couple to raise that vulnerable child. And out of that then comes the sort of cultural invention of marriage. We marry each other because that biological imperative, the way that we have to form bonds between mother and father to raise children. And it became used as a political tool, that you would marry from one family into another family to form an alliance, particularly amongst the elite, particularly amongst monarchies and ruling families. And one of the most influential, one of the most powerful families throughout European history for hundreds and hundreds of years were the Habsburgs. And through this really carefully orchestrated system of royal marriages, of strategic marriages between different dynasties across Europe, the Habsburgs built this enormous empire across Europe and then across the Americas with Spanish invasion and conquest, and into the Philippines as well. It was the first empire upon which the sun never set. It was the Spanish Habsburg Empire.
Hmm.
But in order to retain that political control, the generation after generation after generation married closely related families, married their own uncles, their own nieces. And that served to consolidate political power, but it also started concentrating genetic defects, genetic disorders in each generation. And there are several ways that this expressed itself with the Habsburgs. But it all came to an end with the Habsburg King Charles, who was unable to have children. He failed at even that biological imperative of just having a child, having an heir to continue your dynasty. And the war that resulted from that, the War of Spanish Succession, fundamentally shifted the power structure of Europe at the time, in the early 1700s. So again, there's that story from something deep about ourselves, about how we reproduce, about how we have this emotion of love, about the human family, about marriage, and then some very large knock-on consequences that that's had in history.
You also talk about cognitive bias, and I'm wondering, is that a... cognitive bias is something that I suppose has developed through our psychological evolution. Is it the same, really, as some of the other things you talk in your book? Because it feels like a very new thing, but I suppose, in as you point out in the book, it's really not.
Well, it's been researched recently. It's perhaps the discovery of cognitive biases has been more recent than other aspects of our bodies, of the human condition. But it's just as fundamental. And some of these cognitive biases, which are like almost sort of bugs in our psychological program, sort of glitches in our software, what's really interesting about them is they seem to arise. They seem to happen in people all around the world. It's not a cultural thing. It seems to be something intrinsic to us as a species. And you can often reliably trigger it in an experiment in the psychology lab.
Mm.
So there seems to be something universal about the way our brains work. And these have been called cognitive biases. And one of the examples I explore in the book about these cognitive biases is one that afflicted Columbus, I argue. And Columbus discovered the New World, of course, and he made four separate voyages west across the Atlantic in his lifetime, but never realized himself that he'd discovered a new world and hadn't in fact reached the Orient, hadn't reached India or China in the East. He stumbled across somewhere completely different. And nothing he found there matched his expectations. And rather than changing his belief, rather than changing his mind and admitting he'd found somewhere new that he wasn't expecting, he just simply ignored all the mounting evidence that he wasn't where he thought he was, and just cherry-picked the couple of bits of evidence that supported his prior belief. And he never realized that he'd found somewhere new. And so this is an example of cognitive bias, of the confirmation bias. And Columbus suffered from it, and every one of us today suffer from it as well. It's a huge force behind the increasing polarization in politics, all the sort of echo chambers we're all being exposed to with social media and our online lives nowadays. We struggle to change our minds and we end up just listening to people that agree with us, that don't challenge our beliefs and our opinions. So again, this is something deep about us. This is something intrinsic to our human condition.
Yeah, and it's not something I hadn't really thought about having such an enormous effect on, you know, the shape of our current society. But you talk about loss aversion in the book as well, and the example of the Cold War. I mean, these flaws in our ability to understand the world that are very, very human can have enormous effects, really.
Yeah, they can. And the loss aversion one is an interesting one. And simply put, we feel much more intensely the loss of something than the equivalent game. So, for example, you would be much more intensely affected if you realised you'd lost 10 euro out of your wallet than if you happened to find 10 euro on the street walking around. We feel losses more than we feel gains. And this affects our everyday lives, but it also affects, you know, geopolitics, international diplomacy. And the Cold War, when the Soviet Union and then Russia was in negotiations with the United States for things like arms control and in particular disarmament talks over nuclear weapons, it was incredibly difficult to reach any kind of agreement at all because both sides felt they're getting the bum end of the deal. And every time the US agreed to destroy some of its or dismantle some of its missiles, it would have expected Russia to dismantle more of its own for it to feel equivalent to the United States and vice versa with Russia. And clearly it's difficult to come to agreement if both sides want more out of the other than they are willing to give themselves. Mm. It's just hard to meet in the middle. And so again, you say it's sort of international consequences of individual, personal aspects of our lives.
One of the more the interesting parts of the book that I found was the part that dealt with disease and diseases that really specifically affect humans and how they have had, as I say, our susceptibility to disease. Obviously, things like the Spanish flu and so on can directly affect by reducing numbers, but actually, our fear of getting a disease or the way a disease presents can actually hugely affect, a psychological approach to just being in society and have a trickle-down effect on what our world looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Diseases, are a huge factor on history. And I look in the book at both endemic diseases, so where there's a disease, sort of present at all times in a particular region. So malaria in Africa, for example, versus epidemic diseases or the pandemic disease that we all lived through with coronavirus just a few years ago, where a disease suddenly breaks into population, spreads very, very quickly. And there are some huge effects of both those kinds of disease. And one of the examples I look at in Being Human is the endemic diseases that became established in the Americas, in the tropical regions where it's very warm, and mosquitoes and other insects thrive. And yellow fever and malaria became established in the New World and ended up leading to the political union of England and Scotland. And this happened because Scotland was trying to establish a sort of a trading network for itself. It wanted a bit of this international trading merchant money that England was enjoying at this time in history. And Scotland founded a colony on the Isthmus of Panama, so that the narrow thread of land between North and South America as part of what was called the Darien scheme. They founded their own colony. And unfortunately, that colony failed, largely because all the colonists got sick and ended up dying of endemic diseases, of tropical diseases like yellow fever in the tropics. And because so much money had been sunk into that scheme, so much investment in Scotland had gone towards it, and everything was lost when the colony collapsed, that it weakened the economy of Scotland so much that England could effectively launch a sort of hostile takeover. England forced the union, the political union of Scotland with England at that time, which is why we now have the United Kingdom. That was the beginnings of the union of these separate nations from diseases on the other side of the world at this time.
I hadn't heard that story, and actually I hadn't heard hardly any of the stories in the book, which is really well written. It's by Lewis Dartnell. The book is called Being Human, How Our Biology Shaped World History. Professor Lewis Dartnell, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Jonathan. Cheers.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.
The Capital Ideas podcast now features a series hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover what differentiates their investment approach, what learnings have shifted their career trajectories, and how do they find their next great idea? Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.